Well, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone who's here and everyone who's listening online to this message. And I want to thank Cody. Where's Cody? There he is. Yeah, I'd like to thank him for his sermonette. A lot of good points in there. A lot of things that ring true, too, about reading the Bible, always finding new things in there. So appreciate that. Well, I'm going to start with an article that I read almost 2 years ago now. It was from Harvey McKay's column in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I'll share a story that he told in there. The story is this. A CIA agent was told to find a small village in Ireland and pick up some highly sensitive information from a secret operative station there, whose name was Murphy. The CIA man was told the agent would identify himself when he heard the code phrase, "The sun is shining, the grass is green, and the cows are ready for pasture." So that was the code message. So the agent located a small village in County Cork and checked into a local guest house under an assumed name. Seeking to stretch his legs, he was walking down a country road when he saw a farmer coming toward him. He stopped the man and said, "I'm looking for a man named Murphy." "Well, you've come to the right place," said the farmer, "but we have a butcher who's named Murphy, a baker named Murphy, and an auto mechanic on the edge of town who is named Murphy. In fact, my own name is Murphy." Thinking he might have stumbled under the right man already, the CIA agent softly repeated the code phrase, "The sun is shining, the grass is green, and the cows are ready for pasture." "Oh," said the farmer, "you're looking for Murphy the spy. He's in that town in the other direction over there." Now, that may sound like an introduction that has nothing at all to do with a sermon message, but it does lead into my topic, which deals with spies and spying. In particular, I'll be looking at what the Bible has to say about it and how it can challenge us to look at our own lives, both now and in the future. And by future, I mean both our physical future lives and also our future lives in God's kingdom. Now, people in biblical times were familiar with spies. We know that. We can find it by reading in the Bible. We can find an early mention of it and its punishment in 2 Samuel 10. 2 Samuel 10, in verse 3, as a background, maybe I should just start at verse 1 to give you the background. 2 Samuel 10, verse 1. "It happened after this that the king of the people of Ammon died, and Hanun his son reigned in his place. Then David said, 'I will show kindness to Hanun the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me.' So David sent by the hand of his servants to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the people of Ammon. And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun their lord, 'Do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it?' So they were suspicious of him. They knew about spies. They knew that things like that were going on. And they were thinking that David had come in there just to spy. And so the punishment for spies then is shown in verse 4. "Therefore Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half of their beards, cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks, and sent them away. When they told David, he sent to meet them, because the men were greatly ashamed, as well they would be, appearing like that. And the king said, 'Wait at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return.'" So that was a punishment for spies. Now, people also knew that they had to be wary of spies because they need to be wary of what they hear and what they believe. Spies don't always bring back the truth, but sometimes they tell us what we want to hear or what they want us to believe. The Bible mentions such actions in both the Old and New Testaments. For example, in 2 Peter 2, Peter talks about destructive doctrines, the doom promised to false teachers, and the depravity and deception that they bring. Now, this is referring to false teachers, but we could also apply it to spies, and what they do, the word that they bring back. This is in 2 Peter 2, verses 1 through 22. And I'll be reading parts of all the verses in there. 2 Peter 2, verse 1, "But there were false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber." So we need to be aware of what we hear. We need to be able to discern whether these are true teachers, true prophets, or false ones. And likewise, spies or others. In verse 4, still in 2 Peter 2, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. They are presumptuous, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries, whereas angels, who are greater in power and might, do not bring a reviling accusation against them before the Lord." So this is false teachers. We have to be aware of them. They won't always bring the truth. But angels, it says, are greater in power and might, and they do not bring any kind of accusations before the Lord. And the same chapter goes on to talk about the depravity of these false teachers. Verse 12, "But these, like natural brute beasts, made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil of the things they do not understand, and will utterly perish in their own corruption, will receive the wages of unrighteousness as those who count it pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. They have a heart trained in covetous practices and are accursed children. They have forsaken the right way and gone astray." And it describes a little more about how depraved they are. I'd like to skip to verse 18. "For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage." Well, Mark also tells us to watch out for false Christs and false prophets. I would add that we also may need to watch out for anyone else, whether it be spies or anyone else who seeks to deceive us or lead us away from what we know to be the truth. Matthew 13, 22 warns us, "For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. They will try, and we need to be aware of it. But take heed, see, I have told you all things beforehand." Now, in addition to these warnings, there are also a few general references to spying, mainly accusing others of using spies or being spies themselves. And I'll mention three brief examples. I won't go into detail, but just mention them to show that spying was an active activity in those days and that people needed to be aware of it. Now, I've already mentioned the first example when I read a 2 Samuel 10:3, David being accused of being a spy. And this warning is repeated in 1 Chronicles 19:3. And you don't need to turn there. It says basically the same thing. And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanan, "Do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Did his servants not come to you to search and to overthrow, to spy out the land?" So that's repeated where David and his people were accused of being spies when really they weren't. A second example of spying that I'll just mention, this can be found in Genesis 42. You don't need to turn there. I think you're pretty familiar with this. This is when Joseph's brothers came to Joseph in Egypt to buy food for the family. Now, you remember how it happened that Joseph was captured, brought into Egypt, and he rose in rank, and he suddenly was one of the top rulers in Egypt. So his brothers came to Joseph because there was a famine in the land, and they were starving. They needed to buy food for the family. Now Joseph, when he saw them, he knew who they were. He knew they were his brothers, but he pretended not to recognize them and accused them of being spies. Genesis 42, verse 7, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. They had no idea that he would be there. They had no reason to think that this would be their brother Joseph. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You are spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land." Now these dreams are mentioned in Genesis 37, and we won't go there and read them. I'll just mention them. One was he and his brothers, a dream of them binding sheaves in the field, and Joseph's sheaf arose and also stood upright, and his brothers' sheaves all stood all around and bowed down to his sheaf. Of course, that didn't go well with his brothers. And the other dream he had, it's mentioned in verse 9, the same chapter, Genesis 37. He said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So those were the dreams that came to mind when his brothers came to him, and he realized that, in effect, this was happening. Now, a third example of spying is found in Judges 18:2, and this is when spies were being sent out from Dan to spy out the land. And just a brief reference here, just a couple verses. Judges 18, verse 2. "So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtol, to spy out the land and search it. They said to them, 'Go search the land.' So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there." And it doesn't give us any details about that. So these three brief references, the one of, the one of David being accused of spying, and secondly, the one where he tried to accuse his brothers of being spies. And then this third one that I just mentioned, which it doesn't give us any detail about, spies were being sent out from Dan to spy out their land. They indicate that spies and spying activities were recognized and were familiar to people of the time. They knew that that kind of thing happened. Now, there isn't much substance to those three examples, and not too much that we can gain from it just looking into them in more detail. But we have two other major incidents in the Old Testament, and they're described in great detail. They're described in concept and delivery and results, so we know a lot about them. Both involve spies being sent out to search the land that Israel was to inherit. In the first case, Moses sent out 12 spies, brought back a report of the land, and that's probably the example we're most familiar with. And in the second case, 40 years later, Joshua sent out spies to search the land. I want to look at those two examples in all the detail that were given about them, and then look at some interesting analyses that can be drawn from them. Interesting in that I found an article about that, and it brought up things I hadn't thought about. You can turn to Numbers 13 for the example of Moses. Numbers chapter 13, this is where Moses is sending spies into the land of Canaan. Numbers 13, verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. So these 12 men represented the 12 tribes. Verse 3, so Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of the men who were heads of the children of Israel. These were prominent men in their tribes that had been selected to go and spy out the land. Their names and their tribes are given in the following verses, 4 through 16. I won't read through those, but the names of interest to us are Caleb, who's from the tribe of Judah, and Hoshea, or Joshua, the son of Nun, from the tribe of Ephraim. And just to prove that the other names are unfamiliar, you can raise your hand if you've heard of any of these: Shamua, Shaphat, Egal, Palti, Gadiel, Gadi, Amiel, Sepher, Nabi, and Guel. They're all unfamiliar to us today. And I don't believe that they are mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. They're just mentioned by name as spies that went into the land. Now, Moses gives them some instructions in Numbers 13, starting in verse 17. He tells them where they're supposed to go and what they should look for. So then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way into the south, and go up to the mountains, see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are forests there or not. Be of good courage, bring back some of the fruit of the land. Now, the time was the season of first ripe grapes. Now, these are rather detailed instructions. Depending on how you count them, he said to go this way into the south and go up to the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are forests there or not, bring some of the fruit of the land. If you count them like that, there were up to 10 things that they were instructed to do or to look for. The spies are gone for 40 days. They return with grapes, pomegranates, and figs. That's what's mentioned. possibly brought back other items as well. We don't know, it doesn't say. In Numbers 13 and verse 21, so they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob near the entrance of Hamath. They went up through the south and came to Hebron. Mayim, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were there. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. I'm not sure why it's important for us to know that, but there's probably some reason. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there they cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes. They carried it between two of them on a pole. I think we've probably all seen pictures of that or can imagine it, these two men carrying a long pole and this huge cluster of grapes on it. They're so many grapes, so big, so heavy. And it was such a rich land. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. And then they come back and bring their report, verses 26 through 29. Now they departed, came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them. There were, I don't know how many, hundreds of people gathered around waiting to hear word of what they found. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told them and said, "We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey. This is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan." Then Caleb speaks up and gives his recommendation, verse 30. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, now you can imagine that as Moses is describing this, that there'd be a lot of chatter and discussion and maybe shouting or opinions being expressed. Caleb quieted them down and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants." Now this is their opinion or their impression, trying to support their conclusion that they can't go in there and conquer it. They say, "It's a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." Now that was likely a true report. Remember, this report was brought back by all 12 of the men who had gone out there. So they all agreed to the same report. They weren't denying anything that was said. But the example of grasshoppers would have been misleading. A large grasshopper, I looked this up, it can be up to 7 centimeters in length. And let's just say it could be up to an inch, because they get kind of big. And if we estimate its height to be the same, then a 6-foot human would be roughly 26 times the height of the grasshopper. Now, if the grasshopper were then compared, or if these men were compared in size to the giants that they saw there, then the humans would have to be roughly 26 times of, say, a 6-foot human, 5-foot human. In other words, you're looking at what would be the equivalent of about a 15-story building. So they were stretching that point a little bit. I don't think that could be true. But that was the first detailed example that we're giving. The second example happens about 40 years later under the command of Joshua. And Caleb reflects on this in Joshua 14:7. If you'd like to turn to Joshua 14 and verse 7, you can read what he remembered from it 40 years after the fact. And remember, both Joshua and Caleb had been in that first group who had gone in. So Caleb says, Joshua 14, verse 7, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. So Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land where your foot has trodden shall be your inheritance and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. So Caleb and his people were promised this particular area of land. Verse 10, and now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years. So he was 40 years old then, 45 years more, he was about 85. Ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now, here I am this day, 85 years old. And yet, I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so is my strength for war, both for going out and for coming in. Now therefore, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there, that the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. Well, God's command is given in Joshua 1, verses 1 through 9. A little further back, these were Caleb's reflections afterwards. Joshua 1, verse 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses. So Joshua was going to be granted every place that he walked in. From the wilderness and this Lebanon as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance, which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do it according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage? Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. So then Joshua gave his command to the officers. The command is passing from the top down. Joshua 1, verses 10 and 11. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourself, For within 3 days you will cross over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Verse 16, the officers accept these orders that Joshua has given them. So they answered Joshua, saying, "All that you command us, we will do. Wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we heeded Moses in all things, so we will heed you. Only the Lord your God be with you, as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your command and does not heed your words, in all that you command him, shall be put to death. Only be strong and of good courage." That phrase, "be strong and of good courage," occurs 4 times in that chapter, because God knew that they may kind of lose their nerve a little bit, but he's assuring them that he's with them, he's going to guide them, he's going to strengthen them, he's going to lead them, and they will possess that land. Now, before they head out, Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out 2 men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." Now, remember that Joshua was one of the 12 spies sent out by Moses. So Joshua also sends spies, but not 12. He only sends out 2 men. So continuing in Joshua chapter 2, verse 1. So they went, these 2 men, and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the woman took the 2 men and hid them. And we know that Rahab knew that these men were from God. As we read further in the chapter, we find that Rahab knew about the Israelites and feared them. And not just she, but all her people, or the people of her land. The people of Jericho knew of the miracles that God had performed for them and for their behalf. Joshua 2, in verse 8. Now, Rahab has hidden these 2 spies up on the roof. And verse 8 of Joshua 2, "Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the 2 kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you.'" That's such a strong phrase, "our hearts melted." And maybe you've felt that when things just seem to be so much against you. You don't know what to do. Your heart just almost fails you. And that's how Rahab and her people were feeling. But Rahab gives them conditional shelter and protection. And I say conditional because she asks that she and her family be spared when Jericho is overrun. In verse 12 of Joshua 2, this is Rahab speaking. "Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death." So the men answered her, "Our lives for yours, if none of you tell this business of ours." So they're promising on their lives that they will watch out for her and her family. "And it shall be when the Lord has given us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you." And we know that this agreement was honored during the conquest of Jericho. We can see it mentioned in Joshua 6:16. And this is when they're marching around the city of Jericho. They're marched around blowing their trumpets. And Joshua 6:16, on the seventh time it happened, when the priests blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent." So they were strongly instructed that she had to be protected no matter what. And if we look ahead to James, we can see that Rahab is mentioned in the book of James 2:25 and 26, and you don't need to turn there. James 2:25 says, "Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also." And that's the end of that example. Now, these two spying examples, the one of Moses sending out the spies and the one of Joshua sending out the spies, give us much more detail, sufficient detail to analyze them. And they have been analyzed and compared in an online article. I'm sure they've been compared in many other places, but one online article I found was called "A Bible Lesson on Spying" by John M. Cardwell. Now, at first impression, the source of this article might seem to be surprising, but it's actually very logical, because the article indicates that this study first appeared in the winter 1978 issue of the classified spy journal, Studies in Intelligence, that was put out by the CIA. So the CIA was looking to the Bible for information on spying. Now, I found it only because I was searching for spying in the Bible, not because I was searching through classified CIA articles, in case you're wondering. But I'd like to quote a few paragraphs from that article because it brought out some things that I hadn't considered. So I'll be quoting from "A Bible Lesson on Spying" by John M. Cardwell. The article says, "Today," and this was 1978, I think, 1978. So today in 1978, the CIA and the nation are confronted by a perplexing situation. How can we engage in secret operations with oversight of these operations lying essentially in the public domain, meaning Congress, and conduct inherently insidious spying activities that also must also conform to traditional non-spying standards of ethical conduct and morality? So they wanted to use these examples, but only in a way that conformed to the laws of the nation, and in recognition that some of this would wind up in the public domain. Continuing in the article, "In an effort to seek some solutions to these problems, it is natural that we should explore historical precedents to determine what lessons and insights the past might offer. One rich source of information that should not be overlooked is the Holy Bible," quoting from the CIA article. "The purpose, therefore, of this discussion is to explore the issue of spying as it occurs in the Bible and examine the lessons it might offer. Perhaps new perspectives can be found that will offer guidance regarding how one nation under God should go about the business of spying." So that was their goal. And then it goes into their analysis of these two spying incidents. Continuing to quote, the contrast between these two incidents is significant. Moses used 12 people, all amateurs, each with both political and military responsibilities in his own tribe. Each was a prominent individual who was named in the Bible. And remember, I read that list of names. We don't know anything more about them, but they were mentioned by name. On the other hand, Joshua apparently used two professional, anonymous people to conduct his mission. And the article, this professional anonymous, the article called them professional because throughout they were referred to only as spies. So that's who they were spies. And anonymous because their names aren't given. So they were professional, anonymous spies that were sent out. And again, quoting directly from the article again, Moses' spies brought back reports only of the physical characteristics of the land, whereas Joshua's also reported the attitude of the people. The spies Moses sent made their report openly, and the discussion that followed was conducted in public. Remember, we read that. He read these, or they presented the results in public with people gathered around them. Joshua's spies, by contrast, reported only to Joshua, who then made the necessary decisions. Moses' spies, who also would have been principals in any military action to be taken, participated in the decision-making process. These spies were leaders of their tribes. They were very high, and therefore they would be involved in whatever decisions were made. Joshua's spies neither had leadership responsibilities, nor did they participate in the policy-making decision process. The consequences of these two operations are significantly different. Moses' operation, conducted by amateurs more or less in the public domain, resulted in a weakening of Moses' position of authority. It led to a loss of people's confidence in themselves and precipitated an extended period of severe national punishment. Joshua's operation, conducted in private by professionals, led to an achievement of national destiny. I'm still quoting right from this article. And continuing, an implicit point is made regarding the procedures used during these two spying operations. It is not specifically stated, but one is left with the impression that the 12 spies sent by Moses more or less went about their business as tourists, and the report they brought back is typical of the kind of thing that a tourist would report. Now, breaking from the article, I never thought of them as going around like tourists, but that's what they make it sound like they were going out as sightseers. Continuing in the article, the information reported to Moses consisted both of facts and conclusions drawn by the spies. The negative report given by the majority of the spies, for example, reflected their perception regarding the consequences of military actions, which, if taken, they would be called upon to lead. The people agreed with the negative position, not because of facts reported, but because of the negative interpretation given these facts by individuals of prominence. Joshua's spies, on the other hand, went in secret, although they were discovered, and visited a harlot who gave them valuable information regarding the attitude of her people. These spies did not interpret this information, but simply reported to Joshua what they had been told. No moral judgment was made regarding the fact that Joshua's spies visited a harlot, nor is the information provided by her judged to be of questionable validity. And that's the end of the quotation from that article. But I found it very interesting to hear their analysis of it, because I hadn't thought about the consequences and why things may have happened the way they did. Now, there are other indications of spying mentioned in the Bible. I mentioned some just references to it first, and then these two major examples. And then it's referred to in other areas. But what does that mean for us? How do these two main examples affect us and our thinking? And without looking at that, there's really no point to this sermon. We all like to imagine that we'd be like Joshua and Caleb rather than like any of the other 10 spies. And remember their names, Shamua, Shapha, I don't remember them either. But it's quite possible that we would have fallen in with the news brought by the majority. Now remember too that this report was agreed to by all 12 of the spies, including Joshua and Caleb. They didn't disagree with the content of the report at all. It was just where to go from there that they had different ideas. It was only the follow-up actions that they disagreed upon. Now when 10 out of 12 people tell you that you couldn't possibly win and it would be foolish to try, there's a good chance that you would agree with them. There's comfort in numbers. But we don't know how we would have responded in that situation at that time. I know that I would have been a little bit intimidated by the 10 versus the 2 and hearing these stories about the giants, even if they were exaggerated, and looking at our numbers and comparing them to what we are led to believe the numbers of the people there were. It doesn't really mention them, but. So I don't know how I would have reacted in that time. Now, the Bible mentions other things about spying in terms of our own personal character, and in general, it condemns the practice. It says in Luke 8:17, it says, "For nothing is secret that will not be revealed, nor anything hidden that will not be known and come to light." So if something is going on that God wants us to know about, even if it's a secret of some time, of some type, he will reveal that to us when the time is right. Now, what about today? What about spies today? Well, in our world today, there's certainly much spying going on between individuals and nations. And in a way, we ourselves are like spies, in that we, by our examples and our beliefs, are providing a report to others around us, showing what God's way of life is like or can be like. At some point, possibly in this physical life, we may be required by our actions to give a report to those around us. And it occurs to me, did I give you the name of this message? The name of the message is, "What is your report? What is your report?" So we may be required by our actions to give a report to those around us. Now consider 2 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4. 2 Timothy 2, 1 through 4. "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses. Commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that we may please him who enlisted him as a soldier." So we're told to be strong, and we have to be faithful. And by our example, we have to give a true report and not tell people what we think they might want to hear just to please them. What kind of report will we be giving as a soldier of Christ? We see a couple of objectives given in Matthew 5 and 7, and there's just one verse in each one, so you don't need to try to turn there. Matthew 5 and verse 16 says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." That was Matthew 5, 16, so that's one of our objectives, to let our light shine. Matthew 7 and verse 12 says, "Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets." That was another something that we need to keep in mind. That was Matthew 7, verse 12. And then a summary of our objectives can be found in Matthew 6, in verse 8. Just a small section, Matthew 6, 8. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Well, then, to summarize this message is dealt with the topic of spying as it's illustrated in the Bible. We've seen concern about spies in David's time. Paul warned us to be careful about how we act after hearing what others say because of false doctrines and because of the doom, depravity, and deceptions brought by false prophets. We saw also that spying was well known in the time of Joseph and his brothers. And then we examined the two major spying acts that were described in the books of Numbers and Joshua. We then looked at a comparative analysis of the techniques used by Moses and those used by Joshua when they were exploring the land that God promised them. Well, where do we go from here then? Our physical lives today may be used examples for others who God may be calling today. There may be others looking at us, looking for answers, looking for solutions to their problems or trials. And the time will come when everyone who never had an opportunity for salvation will be resurrected and will need to be taught. We may be providing part of their teaching. You might say that we will be giving them a report by the examples we can provide. We do need to make the kingdom a reality in our minds, and it is proper to focus even more attention on it as our own lives become more troubled, more anxiety-ridden. The kingdom is our hope, and our examples may be giving a message or a report to those around us. What will your report be?